No, absolutely. Much more significant than everything the United States did in Afghanistan and Iraq. That's important. This detail we're about to talk about is infinitely more important and had much larger ramifications than everything that the United States did in Afghanistan, Iraq, the rest of North Africa, and the Middle East. Was they basically decided that, we're going to need to step into this international banking system.
Hello, and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. We are your hosts, Rory McElhone. I do all the technical bits. And political, a man who's very intrigued about politics, and author, Robert Morris.
How's it going today, Rory?
Today's going very well. I'm just worried about all these dang internets.
The internets are often confusing, often
all those many pipes.
All those many pipes. And that's a great segue, because in part what we're talking about today is what I believe to be the best U.S. Empire book of the year, which I would highly recommend.
Until yours comes out next year.
Exactly. You know, it'll be stiff competition next year if these guys have another book coming out called Underground Empire, How America Weaponized the World Economy. And a huge emphasis of that is those pipes, the internet pipes, and how the United States has been able to weaponize them. And importantly, it's just one of many things that they cover in this book, which I enjoyed thoroughly.
Because I was just thinking about recently that, like, maybe, 15 years ago, any sort of mobile phones, cellular phones that were for business-focused would have been a Canadian company called BlackBerry. And your more ordinary cellular phones, mobile phones, would have been a Finnish company called Nokia. And they have both been replaced by American companies like Google and Apple.
Very, very true. Very, very true. The incredible hegemony of U.S. tech companies is kind of shocking. I mean, I came of age in the 1980s when it was Japan that was ahead on everything. They were the real true leaders for tech. And if you wanted to get, even into the early cell phone era, if you wanted to get excited about something, it was something that was happening in Japan. And that is not been the case with the smartphones. That's not an aspect that they get into in this book, Underground Empire, but that is certainly just yet another dynamic.
Ties into it.
Yeah. I just want to, so first off, before we start talking about Underground Empire, I think it's important to emphasize that Henry Farrell and Abraham Newman would not agree with me on many things. And I think that in today's discussion, we're probably going to use this book as a jumping off point for me to say much, much more than they would be willing to say. These are very respected and respectable American academics. I am a quite scurrilous internet commentator, and I think, willing to say much more sweeping and possibly they would say incorrect things. So I love this book. I think everybody should read this book, but I do not want to create the impression that they would endorse anything that I'm saying about this book. Yeah, so I think that's a good first thing to say. Second thing to say, Rory, is I love this book. Like, I felt like finally somebody is seeing what I have been seeing and talking about for the past decade. I've emphasized in a couple podcast episodes and in a few YouTube videos how most of what we discuss as U.S. Empire is barely the tip of the iceberg. It's it's gross and it's loud. You know, Israel, Gaza,
Well, I always feel like
Middle
these
East.
Are the physical things. I remember someone, it was a train with a load of tanks on it. And it was this person being like, this was in America, and they were at a crossing, and they're like, are we going to war? And it's like, when you see, 20, 30 tanks that cost both 20 million each, it feels really real, but there's just so much happening that we have no concept of. The sheer amount of financial transactions happening right now that really control the world. Like we've talked about before, if you really want to destroy a country, you sanction it, you don't really invade it.
War is horrible. War is profitable. And war
and
provides...
War is a racket.
War is a racket, as Smedley Butler would say, yes. But and it provides drama. It provides compelling imagery, it provides compelling narratives that we all want to get on board with. But really, it's got very little to do with how U.S. power works, and it's got very little to do with the foundations of U.S. power. One of the most frustrating things I hear out of Washington, D.C. commentators and think tanks is this farcical idea that, oh, our withdrawal from Afghanistan, you know, is the end of the U.S. empire. It's like, what was Afghanistan's GDP ever? Even Iraq, which was important, used to be more important in the world petroleum industry. I mean, these were tiny, insignificant places. And I've talked a bit about how weird it is when sort of the U.S. military-industrial complex starts trying to talk about serious economies and how much difficulty they have. Folks were talking about, oh, Turkey, you know, 5-6 years ago, people were talking about Turkey's going to get kicked out of NATO and, you know, Erdogan's the new Saddam Hussein. And it's just like, I'm sorry, have you seen the size of Turkey's gross domestic product? That is not a sacrifice country. That is not a country that the U.S. businessmen that hold the real power is going to be willing to turn into a plaything of Raytheon or Lockheed Martin. We're not going to start bombing them. Sorry. One of the incredible tensions of U.S. political life, rarely spoken, is the tension between a lot of Washington, D.C. nutjobs who are trying to start a war in Taiwan and the entire U.S. business community that's just like, what are you doing? China's where our money's at. Who knows how that tension is going to be resolved? But there is so much more. The sad fact is that most of what we've been doing in the Middle East and North Africa, as horrible as it is, as vitally important as I believe it to be to tell more open stories about what's been happening there, it's barely a rounding error. It has nothing to do with the true lineaments of American power. And the way that I talk about it is as American empire. Like, American empire is not another doomed bombing campaign in Somalia. American empire is Google, Apple, is Microsoft. It is sanctions. It is the ever-expanding jurisdiction, international unlimited jurisdiction of the New York court system. It is the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act that forced every bank in the world to create a reporting relationship with the U.S. Tax Authority, the Internal Revenue Service. It is, I mean, these are the things that I've tried to spend more time on. The great challenge, Rory, is that to really investigate and get into the intricacies of how these things work, I think I became one of the world's foremost experts on the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act because I was sitting in a law firm in Istanbul after the Gezi Park protests with nothing to do for 6 months. And that's what it really takes to parse even one small aspect of this underground empire that Henry Farrell and Abraham Newman talk about. That's something that I simply don't have the time to do while I'm following the much more compelling stories that need to be confronted, the sort of standard narratives I feel that need to be confronted. And I just don't have the time to dig into the weeds, which is why it was so amazing to find this book that really does dig into the weeds. These are, and to have them frame it in a way that made sense to me. They're not shy about saying that this is the United States weaponizing the world economy. They're not shy. They call it underground empire. They're not shy in discussing the way that the power really works in this world. And it was just so refreshing. Because these guys, I think one of them is at Georgetown and one of them is at Johns Hopkins, I believe. Yeah, so these are very serious academics and they're not like crazy Marxists or whatever. They're just going into, in some cases, very technical detail, talking about how the U.S. runs everything.
Can you see this damaging their careers in the sense they're like not going with the grain? You know, they're pointing things out that maybe Uncle Sam would like to be left alone.
Well, unfortunately, it's actually been kind of the opposite effect, as they talk about in this book. I don't know if it was Farrell and Newman, or if it was just Henry Farrell, but about 4 years ago, they came out with a paper called Weaponized Interdependence. And I was aware of it. I didn't read the paper, but it was a concept that I saw being discussed more and more. And unfortunately, they sort of pointed out that the United States had all these powers. And apparently the Trump administration read the paper and was like, hey, we can do that.
Oh, they didn't know?
So unfortunately, these guys' very valuable work has actually added to the practice of exerting weaponized interdependence.
They put everything in a row and give them a roadmap and says, this is what you can do?
Exactly. The Trump administration read that paper and was like, hey, we can leverage this, that, and that, and use that to, I believe it was part of their campaign to destroy Huawei, a Chinese technology firm. Yeah, which is a fascinating aspect of the underground empire that they don't make enough of. But no, I think they discuss is that it's so boring, this stuff, Rory.
It's well, that's
so
the
boring.
Whole point of it. It's supposed to be so bureaucratic that everyone's eyes glaze over.
It's boring and it's complex and it's so hard to fully wrap your head around that there's a lot of U.S. bureaucrats who don't realize the power that they have over the world. I talked a lot about the power that the Internal Revenue Service was given in 2011 over every bank in the world. And I don't think the IRS has quite noticed yet because they don't have a reason. They don't have they haven't come up with a compelling reason to go after all of these banks for something. That reason usually crops up because of some geopolitical catastrophe. And that's an interesting way. The compelling stuff, the fun stuff to talk about, the interesting narrative stuff is used as an excuse to expand the very boring, very intricate, very detailed underground empire. And this book is very good in talking about the way that 9/11 worked to do that. One sort of broader theme that I think is fascinating and also sort of dovetails with some things that I've been talking about over the past couple of years is the way that Reaganism or libertarianism or just sort of pro-business fundamentalism has functioned to make the U.S. government almost infinitely more powerful. That's an overstatement, but much, much more powerful. Because one of the real downfalls of libertarian ideology, and I say this as someone who spent a lot of their 20s and early 30s calling himself a libertarian, is that when you sweep away all the restrictions and create this international web of capital, you're not actually making it easy for John Q. Public. You're making it easy for the more powerful to get away with things. And what Farrell and Newman are very clever about pointing out is there is no entity that's more powerful than the U.S. government. So what happened, and I think they identify a executive from Citibank, I think in the 70s and 80s, who was a sort of libertarian advocate or apostle or fanatic. Of course, he worked in business, so he wouldn't call himself a libertarian. He'd be a Republican or a pro-business kind of guy. I think his name was Walter Wriston. The first chapter is named after him. And he was a Citibank executive who worked very hard to internationalize world finance, build the plumbing. And this was pre-internet, but build electronic plumbing, signals plumbing that allowed banks to talk with each other. And very explicitly, part of his mission was to take power away from governments, to create freedom and make it easier for economic actors to work everywhere and do everything. But interesting in doing that, sort of created a series of centralized systems. He initially wanted it to all be controlled by Citibank, and then some Europeans got together and were like, no, we're going to set up the SWIFT service as an alternative. And that SWIFT service, still nominally European, despite doing whatever the United States tells it to do, was initially kind of a reaction to Wriston's sort of libertarian view, but not really libertarian, really libertarian, because his view was Citibank's going to control all this. So this web of banking interactions that was largely free of worked around countries that attempted to do capital controls, that attempted to rein in financial flows, or I don't know, collect taxes, that sort of thing. And it seemed very successful into the 1990s. And people were talking a lot about the withering away of the state or this, that, and the other thing. And then 9/11 happened.
Okay, I thought you were going to say, and then the Soviet Union fell.
No. Well, this was part of the, you know, the Soviet Union falling was part of this victorious narrative, moving forward, and that's what have you. Then 9/11 happened. And in the aftermath of 9/11, the U.S. government, as sort of like a side thing that's probably, no, absolutely much more significant than everything the United States did in Afghanistan and Iraq. That's important. This detail we're about to talk about is infinitely more important and had much larger ramifications than everything that the United States did in Afghanistan, Iraq, the rest of North Africa, and the Middle East, was they basically decided that, we're going to need to step into this international banking system. And because the libertarianism had allowed it, paradoxically had allowed things to become so consolidated, they just had to go to the SWIFT office and say, well, if you don't give us the information we want and start acting against the individuals that we tell you to act against, then you're a terrorist and you're helping the terrorists win. And that was pretty compelling and allowed the U.S. government to work its way into pretty much everything. The whole World Wide Web, the whole architecture of all of these companies that were nominally these private sector enterprises, they just basically, and some of them fought. Some of them are still fighting in some respects. But by and large, everybody got in line. And weirdly, from this very libertarian instinct of we're just going to have this web of capital all over the world that has nothing to do with governments, they created the web of capital. And one afternoon, probably Wednesday, September 12th, 2001, bunch of guys walked into their offices or gave them a phone call saying, that's over now. Doesn't belong to the U.S. government. I think the SWIFT interbank messaging system is still run out of Belgium or something. But it certainly gets in line and does whatever the United States tells it to do. And it's just a really fascinating dynamic that we see over and over again is that, and certainly in U.S. domestic politics, European domestic politics, is that supposedly all this freedom that Reagan and Thatcher brought us actually just brings more centralization, often in private hands. But for anything that matters, the government can just step in and say, we'll take that. We'll take that element of power.
So do all banks lead to America, essentially?
Oh, yeah, 100%. And what's interesting about this book that I think is fascinating and everybody should read is it goes under the tip of the iceberg. It goes under the water, but really it only goes like 20 feet underwater in a 100-foot depth that just gets wider as it goes. Just that element of discovery we were talking about. They wrote this paper that's like, well, actually, if you use this piece of legislation and this network, the U.S. government could totally just crush Huawei. And then the Trump administration was like, yeah, we can do that. That possibility is everywhere in U.S. legislation, in U.S. You know, I talked a lot about the FATCA, the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. So to your question, does the U.S. control all banks? There's two levers, I would say. This book does a great job of discussing the history and the power of the lever of the SWIFT interbank messaging system. That's operated out of Europe, but that every bank in the world uses. There may be some alternatives now, but it's still...
I know that was a big deal with the Ukrainian war, that Russia will be getting kicked out of SWIFT, but that was about over a year ago now, so maybe they've gone rogue, who knows?
Yeah, and I'm not entirely certain how that shook out. But so there's the SWIFT, and they talk about that. They do a great job, but they never mention FATCA in this book. I was surprised. I looked into the index, and they just don't mention FATCA. The IRS has agreements with every, including with China and Russia, I believe, every major economy in the world that says that they're allowed to have a relationship with all of their banks. It's through the lever of U.S. citizens who owe taxes to the United States, but regardless, it's a relationship, and that's a wedge into every bank in the world that can be expanded. This book doesn't go at all into the stuff we talked about with Stephen Donziger and the incredible ballooning reach of U.S. courts. The fact that Ecuador's highest, technically the lowest court in the United States is a more supreme court than the highest court in Ecuador. That's just a thing everywhere now that doesn't get discussed at all. That doesn't come up in this book either. But these are two very serious academics who have jumped into the deep end on five or six issues. They're really great on the post 9/11.
Do you think that's something the U.S. had planned for in case an event came along that they could fully utilize, or was it a pure mad dash scramble?
No, I really do think it was sort of a pure mad dash scramble, and, oh, we can get away with this. And I mean, it wasn't even we can get away with this. It was, this is useful. This is important. It absolutely was important to go after the funders of terrorism. They should have gone after more of them in Saudi Arabia. That's the thing. There was a vital law enforcement justification there. But the way that it's been used, and Farrell and Newman are really good about documenting just how quickly it went far beyond that first implementation. I don't think, I'm pretty on record. If there's a phenomenon that can be described by greed and stupidity instead of a sinister plot, it's greed and stupidity. And I don't even think it's really necessarily greed. I think it's a lot of well-meaning people who think that they're just doing what they need to do to catch bad guys or put pressure on evil regimes or what have you, who are just slowly crushing any kind of independence for any actor other than the United States.
How does the U.S. government use data networks to control the global economy?
Well, that's a very complicated question that I would refer to the Underground Empire. They're great on 9/11. They're great on finance. They have some really interesting chapters on semiconductors, which is something that I found really annoying for a really long time. But it was good to sort of get another potted history of TSMC, the big Taiwanese semiconductor place. But to your question, they talk a lot about the internet. And the fact that we love to talk about the cloud, we love to talk about the internet as if it's this massively distributed thing. It is a massively distributed thing, but because of the history of how it cropped up, because of the fact that both people and physical infrastructure like to be around other technical people and useful pieces of physical infrastructure, a lot of the internet, or the backbone of the internet, is centralized in the United States, and not just in the United States, but in the Washington, D.C. suburbs, which is kind of extraordinary. Yeah, a lot of the backbone of the internet, a lot of the communications networks that the entire world relies upon go through the Washington, D.C. suburbs and have very natural affinities and access for U.S. intelligence community.
So it's not just a coincidence it's all there?
I'm embarrassed to admit, Ray, that I read this book about 3 weeks ago, and I think they explained there was something to do with how government worked. Again, not a sinister plot. The internet was born out of the DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Administration.
But it was also let universities move data about and share their research, wasn't it?
Well, sure. But it was initially that the point of the internet is creating an information network that can survive nuclear attack. That, I believe, is the initial justification. But a lot of they didn't get into ICANN at all, which is sort of interesting. I know there was a huge controversy between, it was just a U.S. NGO that ran a lot of the network that ran the internet. I'm not sure exactly. Not that my technical limitations are showing, but there's something about the address book for the internet or something was run by ICANN, which was essentially US NGO that I think was internationalized. I can't remember how the controversy went, but it was a huge controversy. It was like the rest of the world was like, the entire internet and all of its administration cannot just be owned by the United States. Thank you very much. And I think some of those controversies were resolved in ways that were a little bit better for the rest of the world. But still, the norm is that the U.S. controls everything. And that was fine in the 1990s, or it wasn't that big of a deal in the 1990s. And then...
Oh, yeah, when the internet was incredibly small.
Well, when the internet was, you know, growing fast, but was not as central to life.
Oh, yeah. Like, you basically have to do your taxes, and a lot of government stuff now is all online.
Mm-hmm. But then, of course, as the internet began to maintain a more and more central role in everybody's lives in the first decade of the century, we were dealing with the aftermath of 9/11. So just as those financial networks, as described in this book, Underground Empire, just as those financial networks were manipulated by the U.S. government in the aftermath of 9/11, all of those internet networks began to be messed with as well. They cover the NSA. It's funny. It seems so long ago now, but the Edward Snowden revelations about what the National Security Agency was up to, and talk about how things haven't really changed that much. Certainly, there was some pushback after Snowden. A lot of international, a lot of allies were pretty incensed, and it was seen as problematic and poorly thought of. Generally, things have just sort of plodded along because, again, it's kind of boring and it's kind of technical and it's kind of in the background.
And they haven't been found out as much as Snowden would have revealed. Like, from what I understand, this book is more just piecing together wee bits that are public knowledge, putting in the boring things. They haven't got a massive data leak. They don't really know anything some experts on Wikipedia couldn't, you know, reveal.
Exactly. And that's what's so valuable about this is it's just two academics who have the time, who have the expertise to, again, just five or six facets of this incredible beast. And it's rare. It's vanishingly rare that folks do that. And that's why this book is so valuable and why I think that everyone should read it.
Have we any examples of them exerting the power apart from Huawei?
Oh, tons. Sure. There's Huawei, there's the Biden administration's very sweeping restrictions on the entire Chinese technology sector.
Except Leveno.
Sorry?
I think Leveno gets a free pass because they have such close ties with IBM.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, I heard when they bought their ThinkPad, you know, the laptop part, they were bigger in America now than they were in China. So I think they're one of the few companies that are allowed to still operate because they're kind of quasi-American.
Maybe I overstated. So the tech requirements are incredibly sweeping. They're incredibly draconian. There's a whole class of Chinese tech companies that people with U.S. passports are not allowed to work for. And a lot of Chinese engineers got their educations in the United States, and many of them got U.S. passports. But it is still, at this point, a limited and defined class of Chinese technology companies. I believe specifically...
Oh, yeah, the ones that are very close with the Chinese government are going to be on that list.
Well, but also specifically those that are working on high-end semiconductors, high-end artificial intelligence, high-end defense-affiliated applications. So it's still kind of limited, but it's still incredibly sweeping and kind of crazy that the United States is saying that entire sectors of the Chinese tech industry need to stop now. Think about the ramifications of that. And that's an ability that the United States is the only country that has that ability. And is it the only country that is interested in using that ability? And I think that Farrell and Newman's work is really valuable because it documents the way that they are getting more and more interested in using that. I think a subtext of this book that I might disagree with, or some of Farrell's other work perhaps, is that the United States is going to kill the golden goose. It's going to I was more concerned with this, with the Iran nuclear deal and Trump jumping out. This idea that the United States is going to keep taking these actions, keep doing these things, and then eventually everyone's going to get off the dollar, or everyone's going to do something to punish the United States for this, and the U.S. is going to lose that power. That is 100% a risk. When, you know, U.S. empire falls, it will be because of abuses like this. But I do think there's a much broader scope for the unfair exertion of U.S. power than perhaps even Farrell and Newman would say. What's interesting is in this book, it describes a number of things that we get away with and continue to get away with. I think a lot of people are invested in the narrative that U.S. tech strictures against China are failing in some ways, and maybe they are, but there's like 15 other things we could try. This book is a good start for understanding the absurd power of U.S. underground empire. But it is the beginning of a conversation rather than a sort of conclusive overview.
Is there anything other countries are able to do, or is it sort of too late? America's got its tendrils in the world economy and the world tech sector that it's too late to get out now?
Well, I think I have referred to it in the past as sort of the only other sovereign country, but China. Mm-hmm. China has done a lot of work to maintain tech independence and was famously mocked for this by Bill Clinton in the 1990s.
Now, there's no question China has been trying to crack down on the internet. Good luck. That's sort of like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall.
The consensus in 2023 is that China effectively nailed Jell-O to a wall. As with many things about China, I don't know how true that really is, but there's the Great Firewall. And because of the Great Firewall, I think it is common and entirely accurate to describe the Great Firewall as an authoritarian nightmare dystopia thing that China employs tens of thousands of people to control and censor what is present on the Chinese internet. And it's very dystopian, but it's also sovereignty enhancing. Would China have been able to have the massive tech companies that it does, the Baidu, the Tencents, the Alibabas, if it didn't have the Great Firewall? Europe doesn't have a Great Firewall. India doesn't have a Great Firewall. And those regions don't have tech companies that can compete with Google and Apple and Microsoft. China does, or did, depending on how you view the tech crackdown in China and how damaging that may or may not have been. It's a fascinating aspect of the Great Chinese Firewall that it has allowed them to stay independent from U.S. internet and business dominance to an extent that others have not. There's a reason that Huawei was able to develop in China is because it was a different separate ecosystem that wasn't automatically dominated by whatever the U.S. equivalents of Huawei are. I think it's interesting to think about who killed the international order. I think the rules-based international order, I mean, this is something I want to talk about in a lot of contexts. But I think that this book provides a lot of ammunition for my more cynical approach that really it's the United States that has killed the rules-based international order. Because what they're describing here, at some points I think explicitly, but other times not, is a United States that is becoming progressively less and less interested in hearing from anybody else on any topic. The idea that whereas 20
is that
years
just because it can, it's now just so powerful it doesn't need to talk to anyone else?
Yeah, there's a heavy dose again of 9/11 and just sort of, well, you know, we can, because this thing happened to us, we're allowed to do anything we want, and that's right and good. There is a growing intolerance on the part of the United States for any kind of business competition. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, the tech was Japanese. That was what That was where the tech story was. And it was getting to the point where China, in only some sectors, was beginning to usurp that leadership. For example, in solar or electric vehicles. The United States is essentially saying, no, you can't do that anymore. We certainly acted to crush the Japanese economy in the 1980s through tariffs and things like the Plaza Accords, but nothing on the same level of aggression as Biden's tech policy or Trump's campaign against Huawei. It is pretty extraordinary.
Can you see this being a benefit for the world, or is it only really good for America? Like, can it help world peace in any way? America basically being able to snoop and then be able to focus its own businesses, or is it just a way of America extracting all the resources from the rest of the world?
Farrell and Newman are, I think, a little more cautiously optimistic than I would be. They do talk about, well, gosh, instead of using sanctions policy to further brutalize Middle Eastern countries that don't need it, well, why don't we use these incredible powers to go after people who violate climate change commitments or things like that? I think just basically making the case that I think isn't entirely wrong, that these powers could have been used for good and could be used for better, and in some cases had been used for good. I mean, there are really horrible people that the United States prosecutes that nobody else has. I'm not a big drug war fan, but, large-scale drug traffickers get prosecuted in the United States, and in contexts when they could not be elsewhere. There are certainly positive elements to this hegemony. The expansion of the internet is an incredible boon to a lot of people. It's, more and more people lately would see it as a little bit more of a curse, I would say, but I think that's premature and incorrect. But no, there are absolutely positive elements to this, but you have to invent those as well. And unfortunately, because of the sort of 9/11 aspect of so much of this, like, a lot of it is about coercion rather than, friendly coercion to get people more on board with happy, happy, joy stuff instead of generally it's being used for brutalizing poor countries.
What was the most shocking thing you find on this book?
The extent to which the Snowden revelations didn't change much. They did change things. They did. There was some programs that had to end. There was some pushback. There was some rollback.
Because I think, weren't they, tapping into Angela Merkel's phone? Wasn't that one of the big ones that came out?
Yes, that was one of the most famous ones.
I find that an interesting parallel, because when Britain, after World War II, broke the Enigma code, they gave the Enigma machine to a lot of allies so they could, and then they says, oh, these are completely unbreakable, because it wasn't known that Britain had broke the code at the time. So they would just be able to spy on Canada and stuff and see what they were sending back and forth. So it just reminds me of a modern version of that, where you're just completely spying on your allies at all times.
Yeah, you should never fully trust the hegemon. That's where we're here for us. We're not here for you. We're perfectly happy if some benefits flow downstream, but it is not our main goal. Never our main goal. But yeah, no, it is. It just felt so nice to read this book and be like, finally, somebody else sees what I've been talking about.
What was the biggest point you agreed with? You were like, this is exactly what I've been banging on for 5 years.
The fact, that who killed the international order question, they don't really explicitly come out and say it, but they're quite explicit in a number of instances that, like, this is the United States screwing things up that don't need to be screwed up. This is the United States making the choices to make the world less free, make the world less independent. And it's a real problem. They do focus on the fact that, well, eventually people will stop using the dollar, but they also focus, like, this is wrong. This is the United States acting as, they don't use that this terminology, but as sort of an evil empire or an oppressive empire, a more violent and more repressive hegemon. And not, again, not physical violence, but in terms of using the tools of the courts and the administration and the OFAC or what have you to force the world to do things that it does not want to do.
What was the biggest thing you disagreed with? Or were you pretty much in love with all of it?
I was pretty much in love with most of this book. I think that there are aspects to that I could quibble with, of course, things that I would have emphasized more. I'm not so certain there's as much of a scope for green sanctioning or what have you.
That seemed a bit weak when you brought it up there.
Yeah, I don't think that's something that we should be as excited about.
Human trafficking and stuff, they could probably use it for better use.
Well, I think probably, certainly there are U.S. law enforcement agencies that would argue that that's already being done to some extent. But yeah, it's just a really fascinating book that we probably should have done a podcast about a week after I'd read rather than a month after I read in retrospect. But I do think it is very worth everybody's time, and they should check it out. What I found really poignant, honestly, in this book was just the description of TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation. I think I got that right. You'll no doubt correct me if I didn't. And this is the company that has been at really the heart of semiconductor concerns, the somewhat ridiculous assertion by Washington, D.C. that we must save Taiwan because our semiconductors are there, as if they're some kind of natural resource. I've found that argument quite ridiculous. I continue to find that argument very ridiculous. But it is fascinating. This is probably the first time. This is the lengthiest profile of TSMC that I've sat down and read. And it's actually quite sad. I mean, it is absolutely the Taiwanese government, the U.S. government, and this very successful entrepreneur sort of colluded to make this company, to place this company at the absolute heart of the world semiconductor industry. I think people underemphasize the degree to which Taiwanese and U.S. government support helped that happen. And Chinese government support, frankly, because the Chinese government up until the Trump and Biden administrations was always more interested, and I think is still to an extent, in more connections with Taiwan. But this company managed to leverage cheap labor, high education within Taiwan, cheap labor in, not in Taiwan so much anymore, but on the mainland, to make the most cutting-edge chips. And there's business model innovation here. There's tremendous, you know, interestingly, what TSMC does is they work with a lot of companies that are competing with each other. So it had to be, they had to set up really careful information control within their business. I don't think it's politically correct to call it a Chinese wall anymore, but that is what they used to call that. So it became this incredibly trusted, incredibly innovative company at the heart of the world technology business. And then they were so successful that a bunch of policy folks in the United States decided they were dangerous. And now they've been scrambling after creating this truly marvelous institution, international business institution.
In Phoenix, Arizona?
Well, that's the thing. But no, it's in Taiwan. And they've been now forced to jump through all these hoops by the United States. Then it's the United States, not China, that is deciding to break this sort of business utopia that used to exist. And interestingly, a lot of what the U.S. government is requiring from TSMC is a lot of details about their clients and what they're doing with their clients, because the United States has decided that TSMC is no longer allowed to do business with certain Chinese clients, which is, again, kind of extraordinary when you consider
that. Not very libertarian.
No, no. And yeah, it's some very sad passages from the founder of that company, or perhaps it's just an executive at that company just being like, yeah, like we're just, This beautiful thing we've created, this extraordinarily successful business, has just become a plaything of U.S. obsessions and fantasies. And that is a
too successful
a sad
and too important.
Yeah, that is a, it's a sad development.
It almost reminds me of, you know, when they say the banks are too big to fail, it's almost as if it's too big to be independent.
It's too big to succeed. And that's a really sad subtext going beyond the matter of this book. I mean, that's a real issue for all discussions of Taiwan. There's a lot of rhetoric about, we must support Taiwan, our Taiwanese brothers, or our dear Taiwan friends, and it's like, yeah, but what you're doing, most of Washington, D.C., is figuring out ways to break Taiwanese connections with the main thing that made them a successful business, which was leveraging a successful business country, which was leveraging access to China, whether it's Chinese cheap labor or Chinese manufacturing capacities. You know, Taiwan can't decide to provide those same services to India. What we're watching is it's still an open question, to the extent to which the warmongers will be successful in their competition against the American business class that would prefer to have connections with China. But if the warmongers are successful and turn Taiwan into this big fortress, they're going to eviscerate the Taiwanese economy, because so much of the Taiwanese economy is dependent on interaction with the cheap labor of the Chinese mainland.
Ultimately, do you think America cares? I know it lets on it cares, but it's sort of propping up Taiwan in a, you know, it's good to have a friend that might start a fight with China. But do you think if its economy started to wane, America's really that fussed if America's the one to benefit?
No, not that fussed. It's explicit, and that comes through in the passages in this book, Underground Empire, on what the U.S. government is requiring from TSMC is that's sort of the point. It's like TSMC needs to take all these tens of billions of dollars and pour them into Arizona, where they don't have the connections, they don't have the human resources, they don't have to. It's just that there is no reason for TSMC to be building large-scale fabs in Arizona other than subservience to Taiwanese government and U.S. government politics. But it is the owners of TSMC have correctly judged that they are subservient to U.S. politics and U.S. economics. And that is it. That sort of encapsulates the whole message of this book, Underground Empire, is just that so many of the actors that we normally see as independent, whether we're talking about, every country in Europe or the Fortune 500 or international banks and bankers, are actually much, much more subservient to the U.S. government and what it wants than is commonly recognized. And the crazy thing is that the U.S. government is really just beginning to discover this. Like, this is a process, and these are a series of developments that are only going to accelerate in the coming years and decades. I mean, we're only in, year 30 of the internet or something, and certainly only around year 15 or 20 of mass adoption. More and more levers will be discovered and crafted by the U.S. government.
So is this more like a unintentional growing fungus that will one day meet and America will go, oh, we've got this whole new realm of power and possibility and we don't fully know how to utilize it?
Oh, I think that's a great analogy. I think looking at U.S. power as sort of a fungus, as sort of a spreading thing, is perhaps a little ugly, but is, I think, very on point. The extent to which a lot of this is unintended consequence, the hyper pro business, super libertarian head of Citibank in the 80s created a series of systems that made U.S. government much, much more powerful. And yeah, that sort of thing is just going to keep on happening. That is, I mean, the internet is this incredible, what was that, the HBO show, The Last of Us? You know, the internet is the delivery system of the fungus that is U.S. empire. It's just in many, many, many different ways. I mean, this is U.S. empire. You know, you're in Northern Ireland and I'm here and we're creating a joint thing that sort of talks about U.S. politics a lot. It's sort of crazy.
Okay, well, thank you very much for listening to the More Freedom Foundation podcast on this occasion. And just remember, America owns the internet.
Indeed, indeed.
Next, the universe.
Indeed. Onwards and upwards.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire: What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.